What's happening, folks, and welcome to another episode of the Uneducated Ape Podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Schlutercat. On this episode of the podcast, we have our guest, Jules Hare. She's going to be speaking to us about the transformative power of attention. I'm very excited to share this with everybody. It's been quite some time since we've been able to put up an episode, but seeing as there's a lot more time in everybody's hands these days, it's been a perfect opportunity to connect with Jules, and I've got a few other people we'll be connecting with over the next little while to share their stories and the wonderful things that they do. But today's episode is all about Jules, and we're very excited for her to come onto the podcast, and I can't wait for you to hear from her. And without further ado, Jules Hare. Welcome to the podcast. Thank you for being on the podcast.
Oh, you're so welcome. I'm happy to be here.
It's a pleasure. Maybe you could just give a little bit of a brief introductory to our listeners as to who you are and what it is that you do. I know some people will be a little more interested in hearing about it rather than reading about it. So,
I am one of those people. I completely understand. It's so much easier to hear it from someone else's voice. Mm-hmm. So my name is Jules Hare, and I have been doing cranial sacral therapy, which some of you may or may not know, since I was about 10 years old. And cranial sacral therapy is a very non-invasive, hands-on, energy-based approach to healing. And I started when I was 10 because my mom actually was a cranial sacral therapist, a registered physiotherapist who did cranial sacral in our house growing up. So there was a clinic in our front room. And so oftentimes I would come home from school and she would say, "Jules, can you come in here for a second? Can you just pull in these on their feet or this client's feet?" And I'd say hello to the client and pull on their feet. And I was like, there's something going on at their left kidney. She's like, "Oh, okay. You know what? If you can stabilize there, I'm going to tune into what's connected up here." She was at their head. And so those sorts of interactions happened daily, really, in my reality, to the point where it was commonplace. And as we know about any programming, when something like that is commonplace in your reality and you're able to see energy and feel shifts in the body and talk to spirits sometimes, it's just the norm. So that was my norm growing up. So when I finally was old enough to start my own practice, I wasn't sure whether I wanted to treat animals or kids. And when I started treating animals, I realized a lot of the stuff that the animals were holding on to was their owner stuff. When I started treating kids, I realized a lot of the stuff that the kids were holding on to in their bodies were their parents' stuff. So at that point, I decided I'm just going to specialize in pediatrics and treat, you know, the population of adults, kids of all ages. And it's been my love ever since.
Well, that's amazing. Yeah. So it's been something that's just ever invasive and pervasive throughout your entire life. And it's kind of just collected you to a point where you've actually started to write about it, which is pretty incredible. And I've had a chance to go through the pocket guide, and I'm steadily making my way through the book itself, Three Simple Steps. And I guess, like, just from that little brief introduction as to how your life's been, you know, just in general over the entirety of your existence up till this point, it's kind of led you to feeling like you have a lot to offer other people in the way of understanding how those kinds of things affect their kids. Through this book, this is a pretty great guide for parents at any stage, I think, really. Was there something, you know, in your career, in your life, that really started to prompt you towards wanting to kind of collate all of this into the book? Like, was there some sort of turning point or set of experiences that kind of drove you to wanted to collect this all together in this guide form?
Yeah, I would say that about 5 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, I started working with a business coach. And I said, I know I have a lot to offer. My clinical practice, I've had a year waiting list for new adult clients for the past 3 years. And so I knew that I had maxed out the amount of time I could spend with each client individually, and that although those are really profound experiences, and I, you know, I'm very thankful and grateful for them, it's not a way to reach large numbers of people with the wisdom that I have to share. And I do believe we all have wisdom to share. This is not just me. But there comes a point in time when you recognize and trust that sharing is profoundly powerful, and that you can trust in your own scope and wisdom that that would be beneficial to people. And, you know, it sounds like an easy hump to jump over, but we all know who've ever taken a leap like that, that it's, you know, it takes a lot of courage to trust that something that you know or have learned is of benefit to others. So when I finally got to that point and said, you know what, this is really helping people, I need to find a way to put this out there to the larger audience, then I worked with my business coach. Her name was Mary C. Davis. And as we were working together, she mirrored things back to me that I was saying. And I, it turned out that I, you know, as far as the most potent in my reality, the thing that brought me the most excitement was actually writing children's books. So I started to write a series of books called Peanut Butter and Flying Taco. Now, those works are still in the works. And I had worked with another person trying to bring that to life. And in that relationship, there was some turmoil and challenge, and I learned a lot throughout that experience. And all of a sudden, once that relationship had shifted, this book, Raise Future Leaders, which is the name of the upcoming book that you just mentioned there, Bran, Raise Future Leaders, the three simple steps to transformative parenting. This book was all about how we can interact with our kids, but it's not directly in interaction with our kids, and it is, but more primarily, it's about looking at how our programming as parents, our patterning as people, is influencing our reactions and behaviors, our relationships with the people around us. So somebody said to me, as I had put out some of these videos, they had said, this isn't just for parents though, Jules. You shouldn't just like, just say it's for parents. Like, this is for anybody. And looking at not as raising a leader, you know, your child as the leader, but actually raising the leader, the inner child within yourself, to trust in your own capabilities. And in being able to bring that to a larger audience, as I've explained it to people since I've written it, and anybody who's written a book knows that you learn more about it after you've written it and by taking your own advice than you do, you know, when you went into it thinking that you knew what you were doing. The book becomes the teacher. I was talking with a client the other day, and I said, this is how this same protocol, these three steps that I use in the book, these same three steps are the steps that I use to listen, stop, look, and listen at the body, towards the body, to what the body is trying to show me when I'm working with physical body parts, when I'm working with the trauma that's stored inside of our somatic experience. This is essentially, these steps are so profound that you could apply them to anything. And as long as you're looking deeply at your own self and reactions first, then the response when you direct that attention outward is going to be transformative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's definitely, it's very interesting, the points that you make about, especially the power of attention. You find that to be something that a lot of people, at least in cases where you've had clients experience some sort of a disassociation with their body, perhaps, and maybe that's those parts of them that are feeling injured or unsafe in some way, or maybe lacking attention. Is it something that you've found to be like also maybe a contributing sort of factor to that it, those experiences that are sort of attached from you know, the parent to the child? Like, do you feel that it's usually, this seems to be a kind of, you know, the root a lot of the issues and challenges that people are encountering, just not even as you mentioned, not even just as parents, but you know, even just as like the children, but parents to themselves. Is this something that you find to be kind of like one of the biggest challenges, at least in your own experience, in your reality, is like helping people cultivate that attention?
Yes, I have the great benefit of having been a therapist now for over 20 years, almost 30 years of experience if you count from when I was 10. So I've had a lot of practice and a lot of what I call experience in the experience bank to recognize that when I'm working with somebody, when I bring their attention, and I call it like an attention mirror box, but when I bring their attention to themselves, and that could be that old knee injury from when you were in high school, right? Or that could be that strain getting liver. When I bring their attention there, I just say, just notice. And when I get them to notice, I say, do your best to notice without trying to form a judgment or an opinion. We're just going in with pure curiosity and compassion or love, depending on the wording that that client is going to resonate with most. But we're just observing. And it sounds really simple and kind of boring, but it's something that we often don't do. And our attention is powerful. There's no doubt about it. But we're only used to using our attention in certain ways. We use our attention to see what we think we're going to see. We use our attention to see the result or the outcome that we think we're supposed to see. And if we don't see that, then we're going to get upset. We're not often using our attention to the degree that it is most powerful, and that is in pure observation and noticing and just in awareness. So in the book that I've written with the Connection Hero is the name of the character that I call the diagrams that I've drawn. It has a figure of the flashlight. And the flashlight, and people have used this throughout time. I'm not the first one to use the flashlight as the attention. But that flashlight, when you bring all of your attention and focus it to see something, and you're focusing to see it not for what you want to see, but for what's actually showing up, then what will actually show up is often abstract, doesn't necessarily mean. And that is usually the hardest part when it comes to helping people direct their attention to whatever's showing up is they think it's ridiculous or they think it's stupid. So let's say that I'm working with a client and I say, oh, I want you to just bring your attention to your left knee. And I know there's an injury there, but let's forget that there's an injury there. Let's forget we're seeing anything in particular. Let's just let your body know that you love it and honor it and recognize it's wanting to show you something. And it's been trying to get your attention via this pain, but just be there with it. And bring your full curiosity with it to just see it, feel it, hear it, whatever it wants to show you, just be there with it. And when they do that, it's like, oh, that's really weird. Like all I see are like blue spots. Or, huh, I hear my mom saying, you can't do that. You're not good enough. Right? Or all I can think of is that time when I fell and I didn't think I was ever going to stop falling. And it doesn't necessarily have to make sense. It doesn't have to be related to that knee. And that's where our brain gets really screwed up. It goes, oh, but this is illogical. We can't place this. This isn't making sense. And so often when I work with people, well, every time I work with somebody, the first time I see them, I have to lay down a new paradigm of how I interact with the body and how they can insert their attention in different ways. And I say, I'm going to bring your attention to your body and I'm going to hold my attention there as well. But I'm not attached to what I notice. And if you can do your best to not be attached to what you're observing or feeling, then we can just hear it for exactly how it wants to be noticed. And so, as I was doing the audiobook for this new book of mine, obviously, when you're listening to something, you're repeating it over and over again and going, oh, I think I repeated that three times. And the thing that I repeated three times was, your attention is the most powerful tool you have at your disposal, right? Or something to that degree. And it really is, when you look at the world right now, where you decide to focus your attention, that's where your energy goes, right? If I'm reading conspiracy theories online for, you know, an hour every morning, guess what the whole rest of my day is, unless it gets distracted by something else. It's about thinking about those conspiracies, by seeing those underlining agendas that might be coming up, right? If I wake up and all of a sudden, you know, like you have a new baby, it's like all of a sudden I hear a baby's laughter in the other room, and I see they're delighting in having just found their toes. It's like, oh my gosh, wow, that sense of wonder and awe kind of takes over.
Absolutely.
Unfortunately, that like negativity bias of our brain, it tends to lean into the negatives. And so it's just a survival response. There's nothing wrong with that, but it's so challenging to continue to just be aware and notice, to bring that illumination of just noticing, especially to our own patterns, because we think we're right. Right. And I'm just as bad at this as everybody else, right? We think we're right. Our opinion is right. We hold strong to our programming from our past, our patterning. And to look at that, and that's what this book is all about, to actually take a look at that with attention, without the judgment or expectation, it's challenging. I said in the book, this is simple, but it's not easy, not by any stretch. But I have fully witnessed the profound potential that this has when people do it. People on my table will do this several times a day. I'm able to witness this, and it's phenomenal when they can break through their own patterns. So I know it's possible, and that's why this book had to come to life, because it's potential for the people who read it and get it, and for those who are willing to practice it and try it. I have no doubt that the parents who do it, and the people who are willing to parent their own inner child, that are willing to do this, will notice and be able to be the new transformed versions of themselves and connect to others that they connect to completely differently in their life. So it has the power to change, because I've seen it.
Yeah, the power of transformation when the individual is, you know, the catalyst themselves is probably the strongest part of it all, really.
Exactly. Right?
Rather than having someone drive it for them, you know, you're, as you said, you're a facilitator. You're not necessarily, you know, you're not dictating to them what is and what isn't. You're simply trying to help them guide their attention towards those parts of themselves that are always there. It's just perhaps that they didn't have the light shined on them, as you suggested, right? With the flashlight, which I think is a great, you know, despite not being the first one to do it, it is a great tool for people to relate to, right? Because it's, I find anyways, from thinking about it, even just on a personal note, you find it to be, there's those darker parts of yourself. And, you know, you almost feel perhaps like you are that kid, you know, going down into the dark basement or attic in some old creaky house, you know, and those parts that kind of get left aside or forgotten about, and they gather all the cobwebs and the dust, and they can start to look like things that maybe they really aren't, you know, because your imagination plays tricks on you. And, you know, you see things that aren't maybe necessarily as they are. So, I'm curious, I guess, to know, if, you know, you've said that you've noticed those transformations with people. You know, have you seen it? Cause I know you've obviously seen people over time, especially clients. Like in this, have you ever noticed like, you know, a profound shift in their mind sort of, and by the way, the mind saying more like their attitude or their way of thinking. And then also with, the body, seeing that you would have such a, you know, a direct relationship with them in that capacity as well, with like their actions and behavior. Is there something that's kind of fairly tangible and palpable? Because I know sometimes when people think, about these sorts of things. They can, especially, you know, there are some skeptics and, you know, I understand that perspective as well, but being skeptical about it because of their maybe not being something that's logical or necessarily materially visible. This might be at least something that, you know, they can relate to. So have you, like, even, do you have an example of where maybe someone's, you know, been able to overcome a certain hurdle or anything like that, a specific story that, you know, that's kind of brought about this, a clarifying moment where, you know, it's like, this is really necessary wisdom, you know, and it's real kind of thing.
There are so many of those stories that I, you know, I'm having trouble finding one, which is amazing. It's a great problem to have.
Absolutely.
I've got to witness so many amazing changes, and in some ways they're their own stories. So I've been there with them and I've witnessed it with them. And then I forget them because I can't hold them all for them. But what I will bring about from what you were speaking of earlier is them or you, right? Being the catalyst, you directing your own attention is the most profound. So yeah, as a facilitator, I'm not directing anybody. The only times that I direct are when a body part catches my attention and I go, oh, there's something wanting attention here. Can you bring your attention here? And I'll often say to the person at the very beginning as well, if you're still having a conversation or connecting or feeling some other part of your body, and I say, oh, can you come over here? Please know that you can just say, actually, I'm still, you know, I'm still working on something over here so that I can meet you there, right? Because I don't in any way want to interfere with this self-directed process. But acknowledging fully that, you know, that attention, their attention on themselves is the mirror box. It's that like powerful, powerful charge that we don't often give ourselves. I'm going to use your example first because I think it's a great one. And I know it's real. And I've had lots of people have experiences in that sort of regard where their child self, and you described yours as going into the basement and being scared. Right. Knowing there's, you know, whether it's the basement cellar, for me, it was the upstairs at my grandma's. Everybody can remember some sort of kid experience where they got scared. And this is probably a great time to just bring all of your listeners in. That experience where you got scared, you were by yourself usually. And as soon as the thought of going into that space started to percolate in your brain, like you said, your imagination started to take over, and the imagination is powerful. And something I forget, and Peanut Butter and Flying Taco is all about the imagination, but the imagination is powerful in the fact that the imagination is your attention when it's completely not attached to an outcome, right? But it's still flowing through a framework that is you. So it's super powerful, especially in kids, because the framework is still kind of free forming. It's still creating itself. And it's not necessarily fixed. And so as that imagination takes over, the fear gets really loud at one point, especially since the space you're planning on going into probably has some memory associated with it, whether it's yours or whether it's something that you saw or heard in the past. And that starts to kind of take over your experience and starts to ramp you up. Now, we all know this experience on the inside, and this happens just as much as adults as it does in kids, but it feels somehow technicolor louder when we're kids. And in that experience, when I get to that sort of experience with a client, at that point, I can say, okay, like just notice what you're feeling in your body. And sometimes it's easier for them to say that out loud. Sometimes they'll say, it's really hard to explain. I'll say that's fine. If you can just be in there just to observe it, you don't have to get lost in it, right? You don't have to get pulled into it. Just be there to notice with curiosity and just honor what it's trying to show you. Cause we did tell it that we're here to listen. So just be there to listen. And listening doesn't have to be with your ears. Of course, it's, you know, sensory, any sort of sensory listening. Mm-hmm. And at that point, once you're noticing things, and sometimes they say what they're noticing, and sometimes that's not necessary, And I say, okay, can we just pause for a second? And can we make sure that the adult, so let's use your name, Brand, but you know, you're pulling in the adult self. Can we just pull in adult Brandon? And Brandon, are you okay being here with this child, knowing how they're feeling? Because they just told you or showed you exactly how they're feeling and what they're experiencing. And at that point, if the adult version of you, which is usually quite compliant because you know you're the one who initiated this journey, says, yes, I'd love to be here for this little boy. Then at that point, you get to be there supporting this part of you that was otherwise very scared and frightened in this situation. And in this situation, we're using this as a, you know, as a dark space, but this could be any, you know, quote unquote, dark space in your past. And at that point, when you're physically feeling like you're present, and that younger version of you feels that it's being heard by you and that you're present with it, even just that pure act alone of letting them bear witness to each other together and be heard and be seen and be fully acknowledged and honored, that's a profound shift in itself for most people. Because in that moment, they felt like they were completely alone and they were scared and nobody else was there for them, right? This doesn't have to be, you know, the official dark space. We all have dark times in our realities where we felt all these things. So when that parent or when that adult version can come in and be there with them, not judging them, not telling them, oh my God, come on, why are you so scared, right? Why are you so stupid, right? Like, this is nothing, right? Why, you're so worthless. And all of the things that our inner narrative might have been telling us at the time that we were projecting on ourselves, you're not projecting that on them. And they know that you're seeing them and trusting them and present with them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in lots of other experiences, then that would follow through to having a conversation, whatever that looked like. And again, my role as a facilitator is just saying, and what did he say? Okay, and what's your reaction back to him hearing what he said? Right. So I'm just navigating from the outside and helping there to be some separation between the two. And somebody said the other day, well, isn't that like disassociating? It's like, well, it's kind of the opposite of disassociating. You're bringing space and perspective to the situation. But in doing so, you are yourself both ways. And you're not melting into all of the feelings and blending into all of the hurt and distrust and scared or whatever that dark space is holding for that younger part of you. You're actually just seeing them as separate from you and letting them know that you're there for them, just like a parent would. Right. Mm-hmm. And it's this same part in the book where I mentioned that as a parent, we often want to fix our child or we want to protect them from having anything uncomfortable happen to them. When in reality, it's most important to be there with them and recognize, I can see how uncomfortable this is for you. And I get it. Like, how are you feeling in this? Like, that's so much more powerful than going, oh, well, we don't have to be here. We can just leave. Like, I understand that you're upset. So, you know, well, we can do this next year. Right? Our own discomfort in seeing our kids uncomfortable drives their lack of learning forward, right? You're taking away a learning experience from them instead of being there to support them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The acting more as more as just like a dictator over experiences that they may be allowed to have rather than staying in that somewhat, and I know it's a term that's typically used with the Buddhist approach where it's the observation through non-attachment. And it reminds me a great deal of what it is that you've been describing. So I find that there's a lot of universality to what it is that you're describing and the way that you've brought it all together in a very clear and distinct and simple, but yet profound sort of context is it's quite engaging. I find it very interesting. I guess one of the things that kind of comes to mind when you were discussing the potential of them not having had those experiences is the lack of education. And I do know that you made reference to in the book how you've experienced through some colleagues of yours or friends of yours that work in education that there's been some issue with that as well, even with older like young adults. So, you know, someone else's child who's just embarking onto university or to college, and how that can be a big challenge, you know, in its own right. But then there's also the difficulty of the, you know, the faculty having to contend with parents still being kind of involved in that same way that you were talking about, and with them kind of managing what it is that they're able to do and what they're not able to do. And I found that to be an interesting point. Is there a way that I guess even someone at that age could be able to start to take a little more time to maybe pay attention to those sorts of things? Like, I know there's that kind of, is there a bit of any kind of suggestions that you might make to someone, let's say first time going to college or university, and they still kind of feel like they're uncertain, and you know, they might have had their parents perhaps kind of managing everything from, you know, their very start of life up until this point, to kind of take on a little more, you know, just a little more of their own life in their own hands. Is there any advice that you would give to someone like that?
Well, we all know how challenging being a teenager can be. If I'm sure you had similar relationship with teenagerhood, and all of us had different relationship with being a teenager. But this actually, when you bring this up, and I had said, "Oh, I'll have to think of a good story from my clinical experience," and there was somebody who I once treated, and she was, I think, 15 or 16, and the challenge that she was facing was, of course, in relationship to school and the potential of having to leave her school, and I remember she was a very, very smart individual, and not just intellectually smart, but actually was aware of her body, which a lot of people don't. And oftentimes, people who do dance or gymnastics or cheer or some sort of activity that's quite intense, where they have to be aware of their body, are actually more aware and can step into their bodies in interesting ways, like that a lot of people don't have that interface with their body. And I remember treating her once and her being able to fully acknowledge how she was feeling and just validate that it was okay to feel that way. And you have to remember, this is a 15 or 16 year old. We often think that, oh, kids can't do that. But remember, when you were a teenager, you were more open to seeing and perceiving things in completely different ways. So it's much easier in some ways, as long as you can develop a little bit of a rapport, that they can trust you to be able to build that sort of relationship. And I think it was the second time that I saw her, she had already fully tapped into everything that she had accessed the time before, which was all about her own knowing and trusting in herself and the kind of person that she was. And as a facilitator, I remember there were a couple of times where I said, that thing that you said about yourself, you sounded really sure about that. Like that, there was no questioning in that. Can you tell me a little bit more? Right. So even just those little bits of like, hey, that was really strong and powerful. Tell me more about that. That part, I think, can be of great help in continuing to assist you. And the second time that I saw her, it was awesome, because at the end of the session, I said, so I know that, you know, I'm not sure about the changing of schools or anything like that. This might be challenging for us to get to see each other again. I said, but I think that you have all of the skills that you need to be able to connect to your own inner wisdom. And she said, yeah, she said, now that I understand that it's inside of me. I think I can just keep tapping into it whenever I need to. And, you know, I'll let you know if I need to see you again, but it feels like I got this. Everything feels really clear. And I remember her leaving and me just going, oh my God, she got it, right? Like she had it. She tapped into and was able to trust in herself. And obviously her parenting, her mother was very open to that and trusted in that. So it wasn't a hard, far stretch for her, like it might be for others. But at the same time, she took it, she harnessed it, she just used it. And it was so inspiring to me, who's been doing this forever. And let me tell you, I get inspired all the time by people doing their own work, because it's equally as fascinating now as it was in the very beginning. But for teenagers, it's especially hard, and especially when you're heading into college and university, you're starting to do things on your own. And so there's that parallel of leaning onto your parents, which you want to create distance from, but at the same time, they're the only supportive network you know. And in that dynamic, when you're struggling, of course, they're going to be the people that you go to, because they're always the people that you've gone to. And I think it's most important as parents, optimally it's before that point, but if it has to start in college, university, then that's where it has to start. But that these parents don't just step in and call the dean and you know, make sure, call the professors and get upset that their kids are, this is what we're referring to in the book, that they're trying to take over being the parents even when their children are in university and should be taking charge in their own rights, in their own reality. Because at that point, the kids recognize that even if it's failure, that failure has a great learning potential to it. And it has to start somewhere, or else they're constantly going to be depending on their parents. And those parents are constantly trying to quell their own discomfort and fix things for their kids instead of giving their kids the ability and trusting in their own potential to grow up. Yeah. And I mean, I know some adults who still have this relationship with their parents, and their parents are still fixing things for them. And there's no judgment. There's no wrong or right in that. Mm-hmm. But that dependency is not healthy for the overall well-being of the child or the parent. There's an analogy that I use, not in the book, but just in clinic, that as a parent, we see that our children are struggling with a puzzle. And so we take away some of the pieces of the puzzle. So let's say one is financial and one is emotional. And we go, oh, those pieces are so hard for them. We'll take those pieces away so that they can work with the pieces that are easier. So they'll be able to make that puzzle, and it'll be easier for them. So we're holding on to these puzzle pieces. And meanwhile, the child's going, damn, I got this puzzle, but there's two more pieces and they're missing. Like, why can't I find them? I don't feel complete. And so they're continually looking to the parent. And instead of the parent saying, okay, it's time, here's the puzzle piece. I was holding on to it for you, but I realize now that wasn't right of me. That's yours to figure out. And here's the other puzzle piece. And, you know, I trust you. And this is a major thing in the book as well, is that you have to trust your child. And that is the hardest thing ever. And especially for a lot of us, because we're not in faith-based systems the way that, you know, past generations have been. To have a blind trust or a faith in something is not easy, and we're not practiced at it. So being able to trust that this child can make it, in my case, like can make it to the convenience store that's half a block away, honestly. I remember the first time I sent them to the convenience store and just going, okay. And, you know, I think I sent Hayden alone, so it wasn't the two of them at the time. But I just remember going, okay, he can do it. He's got enough money. He knows exactly what he wants. Right. And that fear of, oh my God, what if something happens to him? Or what if he feels like he's not supported and can't do it? And just having to kind of talk myself down and going, it's going to be okay. And once he gets back, it's going to be different. And of course, it's different because that sense of pride and ownership and trust in themselves because you trusted them, it's so powerful. And I wrote about it several times in the book. And I know so many people who have such a hard time letting their children do anything on their own, that their children are not having these experiences of being able to trust themselves. And the parents aren't allowed the growth opportunity of being able to trust their kids. It's an equal loss on both sides.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they end up losing up on an opportunity to experience that kind of self-empowerment. They don't quite get that same measure or dose of adventure that I think that everybody individually, even collectively, somewhat craves in their lives, you know?
Yes. And also, definitely, the parents, they don't get to see their child thrive and be excited in themselves to then be able to mirror it back to them later to say, do you remember how amazing it felt when you skateboarded down the street and got a library book all by yourself for the first time? Mm-hmm. Right? Like that, being able to reflect that back as a parent is so powerful because it allows the child to feel seen and feel strong in themselves. And then the parent, that feeds us as well in a whole different way. That pride is palpable. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. Sorry, I cut you off. What were you going to say?
No. Just it's confirmation, essentially. Just that they would definitely benefit, by leaps and bounds, and in ways that we wouldn't necessarily be able to see in the immediate situation. But we certainly would be robbed of it, as you stated, of being able to witness or experience any of that at all if we, continued to impose our own fears and uncertainties and doubts about, their capabilities. So it really is a bit of a struggle for sure. I mean, especially just being as a parent to a child, but even that sort of trust yet again kind of stretching into just the immediate realm of who you are, right, as an individual, and having that sort of expressed and shared trust and removal of any kind of doubt, or at least maybe just not removal, but maybe the acknowledgement and the acceptance of there's definitely some uncertainties and there's some variables that are outside of the realm of our control or of our knowledge, but to kind of trust as you have one of the foundational pieces in the makeup of this book. It's definitely one of those pillars in providing a foundation for never missing out on those opportunities when you can have that kind of deep and abiding trust, within yourself. And if you can, I guess, maintain that, then it wouldn't be too far a stretch to think that, if you're able to trust yourself, and, in many cases, at least personally, I always consider myself the biggest version of a kid that I've become at this point in time, in my mid 30s. And it's definitely still something where, I've got lots of learning and growing to do and lots of mistakes to make. And, I'm certainly not alone in that at all. But I think having the acknowledgement of and the acceptance of being, just being okay with those unknowns and the dangers that, may lie on the, the outside of those unknowns. But trusting that, everyone has the capacity and the capability to kind of succeed in what it is that they're aiming to achieve because of having that network of trust. And I think that's something very interesting because the foundation and sort of the formula that you have in the book is very interesting. I like the model a lot, how it's about constructing that foundation to build up to, that potential that you were talking about. It's something I feel that, if you don't have a faith-based system, it could be very difficult and strange almost feeling, I'm sure, to feel like you have a faith, I guess, in yourself, because it's, you know, I suppose you could end up feeling like the idea of faith would be something that sits outside of yourself. But in this case, the way that you've been describing it so far is that it's very much all about faith that's of the internal variety, right? Like it's that completely abiding trust of self. And it's interesting. Like, do you find that, you know, the more that that you kind of have opened up yourself to these opportunities through not only parenting, but just through chasing things that, you know, are going after things that you've really wanted to achieve, even though they've put you on, perhaps put you in a position where you felt fearful or doubtful. It's transformative, I imagine, in ways that you wouldn't have been able to understand if you hadn't taken those opportunities, right? So, yeah, if you were to say that if this book that you've been writing has taught you anything, what would be at least maybe two major things that you might have learned because you've taken that leap of faith, sort of thing?
I think one of the major things, and I know I don't, you know, this is in common with lots of us, but my own unique challenge was growing up, and I don't think this was projected on me, this was my programming that I perceived and made to be true, but it was the fact that I couldn't make mistakes. And I mention it in the book, but you know, I'll go a little bit more into it here, is I felt like I had to be right all the time. And if I wasn't right, then people were going to chastise me, make fun of me. I would be demeaned. Now, did that actually happen? No, but it didn't happen because I didn't let it, because I took this so seriously, so passionately. And in my nature, I recognize I have a very competitive attitude. Now, I see that in my sister and my mom, my aunt, my cousins, my grandpa. Like, this is, I'm quite sure this is a genetic thing. And it's always interesting to be able to see that to such a degree. But my way of coping with it was always to be right. And it wasn't necessarily to, you know, to look into deeply into researching, et cetera, et cetera. It was to be strong and powerful, stand up for myself, and sometimes completely bullshit and make it sound like I knew what I was talking about. And I say sometimes, I know I did that a lot as a kid. And I remember actually somebody once saying, "Jules, like, you're a great therapist, but what is it, do you think, that made you a great therapist?" And I had never thought about it until that point. And I love when things just come about like that, like they do during a podcast, right? It just gets you thinking about things. And I remember saying, I recognized my great ability to manipulate, and not in a nice way. When I was a kid, I remember being really mean to my sister, and I've apologized to her since, because it was, you know, it's one of those things that as a sibling, I think you just practice with the people around you who you know are going to love you no matter what. And that's your little kid sister, your little kid brother, or whatever that is that's available at the time, right? But I remember that I was really mean to her. And there was a point when I recognized that really hurt her. And it probably took me way longer than, you know, than I would like to admit, to realize how much my being mean could hurt somebody. And that I had these skills of knowing how to push buttons and how to manipulate situations and how to do things and make people respond in certain ways that I had just learned how to do. That just felt like natural. And what I realized, though, is that I could have that potential and those skills, and I could use them for evil or I could use them for good. And what felt better? Right. And this is a human thing. And you know, I've dealt a lot with this when it comes to the pandemic as well, and all the potential for conspiracies and power and money. It's like, okay, I can completely relate to all of those things. You know, we have this great sense inside of all of us. It feels good to have power. It feels good to reign control over others or show somebody that you're stronger, right? It doesn't feel good in a peaceful, loving, self-compassionate way. It feels good in a way that's really hard to describe, but it can take over you. Mm-hmm. And I know that you can relate to this too. We all can. It's like that charge that runs through us.
Mm. Yeah, it's like a domineering sort of aspect of our nature.
It's a human nature. It's not a good or bad. It's just a human nature. It's a potential. Mm-hmm. But in recognizing mm-hmm. its power, there is also fully acknowledging and accepting, okay, that's a part of me. And that's something that I think a lot of people forget how powerful that is, to actually recognize it's powerful to embrace that part of you, but not let it drive you, right? This doesn't have to be the one behind the wheel. Mm-hmm. And when I stepped out and recognized that I could use my powers of manipulation, my powers of being able to see buttons and where they're pushed, that I could use that in a really therapeutic way to access where people are stuck or where they're beating up on themselves, and bring their attention to that, bring the flashlight to that experience, and let them see it however it is it wants to be seen by them, right? Because they're in control, that's, or they're in mm-hmm. charge and letting it guide them. That I could use that mm-hmm. those powers of manipulation in a powerful, profound way that is transformative, versus that tries to dominate mm-hmm. over others, transformative, like, you know, in that other sense. And again, not right or wrong, but mm-hmm. I'm glad, and I'm so happy that I've had all the experiences that I've had in that regard, so that all of those mm-hmm. pieces that come alive inside of people aren't judged, because I'm not going to judge it. I completely understand it's all human nature. So when somebody says, oh, I'm almost ashamed to say this, but I felt like I just wanted to crush them, it's like, okay, well, it's most important that we acknowledge that then, right? And what does that feeling of mm-hmm. crushing them feel like? Or what is it in you that wants to crush them? What happens next if that's the case? And I think it's that great power in not having the judgment and fully embracing and loving the light and the dark, or the good and the bad, or whatever you want to call them, that allows somebody to feel fully heard, because there isn't any judgment there. It's like, yeah, I get it. You know, you wanted power and money, and that's the part of you that's corrupt. But a lot of us really want to not be a part of that part of us. And that creates mm-hmm. a lot of challenge in our world. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely a difficult thing to maintain somewhat of an objective observation of ourselves and others when we have such a subjective experience and involvement. Mm-hmm. In life.
And we judge it to such a degree that we don't even want to admit it's there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, most certainly. I mean, just by sheer, we tend to compartmentalize a lot and sort of categorize and label, mm-hmm. and it kind of just fits into a nice little neat box, or kind of a cubbyhole, you know, where it's just you can file it away and then recall it in a very simple and succinct sort of manner, and you don't have to think too hard about it anymore, right? Because there's a pretty crystal clear, by at least our own estimation, definition to those things or those people or those actions and behaviors, and they become very stagnant, I guess you could say. And but life isn't like that. It's not stagnant. And I think the idea or the concept of stagnancy is to a degree in its own way a little unnatural. And I feel like it's more of a human construct than it is a nature construct. It's more of a logic center.
The only thing that's constant is change, right? Well, and definitely you labeled it, like our cognitive brain. It just loves to just put things in categories and solve problems. And it would love for everything to be linear. But as soon as you get into mm-hmm. the body, and that's why somatic experiencing or somatic emotional release or any of those other body-centered therapies, they're so powerful, mm-hmm. But again, they kind of override brain circuitry because your brain can't put that stuff in categories. Our experience can't be explained by the brain. It's a like if our brain is two dimensional, our body is like four or five dimensional. but that's why the non-judgment and the trust is so very important. And you had mentioned earlier, and I didn't fully answer the question, but people's bodies have profound shifts where I can say there was somebody who was going to be going in for surgery for bilateral carpal tunnel. So both hands having carpal tunnel issues. And we were working on, surprisingly, their head. And a lot of the congestion and nerve compression, et cetera, was in the head and neck, which is often the case when it comes to our arms. But there was a lot of revisiting of old patterns of thought, et cetera, et cetera. And as the old programming shifts, the way that the programming or the energetic matrix, the construct of our body paradigm shifts, and then the body can shift. So we often think of our thoughts as being very separate from our physical experience. But you know, I can count thousands of experiences where as soon as the client started to shift the way that they perceived that past trauma or that situation or that, you know, even that old injury, then it shifted the way the injury or the trauma was holding within the physical construct of their body. And this is like endless. This isn't just every once in a while. This is a constant. I've been doing over the phone sessions since this whole pandemic started. And over the phone sessions, people are amazed that they're just as powerful and profound as they are in real life when they're on my table. And the you know, the most important part, and just like I said in the book several times, is that our attention is the most powerful tool. We're bringing our attention to our own bodies, which means we're completely exaggerating the potential of the attention because it's within the system that it really wants it. I would say your body likes my attention, but it loves your attention, right? So both of our attentions together are going to be way more powerful than anything else. And people have had acute injuries, and we've done over the phone sessions, and they have shifted drastically where they're like, oh my goodness, I can feel my feet and the tingling. And I said, did you feel that just release in your head? And they go, yeah. Now I can feel it all the way through our spinal cord. It's like, yeah, that just completely released. And that's not even having their physical body in this space, but I can feel it and see it at the same time as they're feeling and seeing it because our attention is directed to the same thing.
It's pretty powerful and pretty incredible that you're still able to make that kind of connection and work as a facilitator, even still not having, you know, the same kind of access that you would, were we not in a quarantine at this time. So
it's been a learning experience for me as well. Cause I trusted and believe in the power of attention already, obviously, but it's almost like it's emphasized how extremely important and real that is, even more to me, right? Who is already completely a believer. It's always fun when you just take it to that next level.
Wow, that's incredible. Wow, I mean thank you so much for coming on and sharing everything today, Jules. It's been wonderful as always, and I think especially our listeners they'll have quite a bit to unpack through our talk today, which is great. And before we go, you can just let people know when they might be able to get access to the book and to the pocket guide, excuse me. Is there a place that they can go to kind of keep tabs on there if they could sign up for anything like a newsletter?
Yeah, for sure. And thank you so much for having me, Bran. This is it's always, always great to be able to come to new realizations in real time with all these wonderful listeners who are going to be doing their own amazing work and, you know, re-inspire themselves and their own potential. So it's awesome. Right now, I actually just yesterday uploaded the books. They're going to, I'm self-publishing, but they're going to be available. I think the ebook is actually already available. I'm not sure though. I'm going to launch them all at the end of the month is the plan, as well as the audiobook. But for anybody who is interested and wants to follow along, when you sign up on my website, www.juleshare, like the rabbit, H-A-R-E, shares, juleshareshares.com. When you sign up there at the website, you will be prompted to, I think, confirm that you've signed up, but then you will get 3 different videos sent to you within the course of a week. And they're just about different guides or different ways of thinking about parenting and your own paradigm. And then as soon as the book is ready, I will be sending out to everybody on that email list. You will be the first to find out how to order the book. And it will be, like I said, in print form, in ebook form, as well as in audio form. So I'm so looking forward to having people's feedback and to have people share it with people that they know who are actually open to making this paradigm shift, to transforming their parenting by bringing their attention back to their own patterns. And you can check us out as far as the therapy goes at www.cranial, like the head, and waves, like the ocean, www.cranialwaves.com. And you can look at any of the posts that I'm posting on Instagram or Facebook at juleshareshares.com. And again, this book that I wrote, I did not want to make it boring. I have tried to read parenting books before in the past, and I don't know if you've done this as well, Bran, but they can be boring and dry. And so I try to do my best to make all the diagrams, all of the images for these books, all these connection heroes, in funny positions, trying to make sure that all of the kinds of learners, the visual learners, the tactile, experiential learners, tried to include some facts in there for people who really like the factoids. That is what the Raise Future Leaders, 3 Simple Steps to Transformational Parenting. That's the longer book. It's about 158 pages, but it's lots of pictures. The guide that you've been talking about, Bran, that is 42 pages, and it is a picture and a sentence on each page. So that is like the easy route into all the information that I put in the 158-step guide, all distilled down into picture form and short reminders. As one of my clients said, oh, great, I'll read the real book, like the long book, and I'll get my husband to read the pocket guide, because he never reads the long books, but I bet you he'd look at pictures. And I was like, yeah, I guess that's, that's a great use for it. Or you could put it on the table and your kids could read it. Like it's that fun. So who knows what it transpires into. I look forward to this next launch off where it just delivers itself and I have no say or control, right? The next part of trust, no say or control over what happens next. I just have to trust that it touches who it touches and do my best to bring it, deliver it to the audience and see what happens.
Well, that's excellent. I think it's going to reach a great audience. And I think a lot of people are going to be really excited to be able to get this refreshing and engaging perspective on parenting. So thank you so much again, Jules, for being on the podcast. You. It's been a pleasure as always. And we'll talk again.
Sounds
soon.
Good. Okay. Look forward thank you to it again. Ben, and, enjoy your parenting adventure in the meantime as well. Okay, take care.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Take care.
A big thank you to Jules Hare once again for coming on the podcast today. Be sure to check out the links to her websites to learn more about Jules and her work in the episode description. And stay tuned for the official release for her upcoming book, Raising Future Leaders, 3 Simple Steps to Transformational Parenting. I've been your host, Brandon Schlutercat. Until next time, stay safe, happy, and healthy. Cheers.